This item is entitled Individual Choice in Decision Making. We have two people to present. Robert Dinnestein, who is Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Experiential Education and Director of the Disability Rights Law Clinic at American University Washington College of Law, and Chris Booth Glenn, who is surrogate retired New York County Surrogates Court. It wouldn't be right to introduce them in that brief way.
It's fine. Yeah. We're in the program.
Right.
We could just let you read the program, I guess, but Professor Dinnestein has taught law since 1983. This is a significant and important fact. And he was, before that, he worked as an attorney in the Special Litigation Section of the Civil Rights Division at the United States Department of Justice. He served on the President's Committee on Mental Retardation from 1994 to 2001. He's consulted for the World Health Organization regarding the revision of mental health laws in Ghana and Malawi, and he was a signatory to the Montreal Declaration on Intellectual Disabilities adopted in 2004. And he sits on numerous boards and has significant other honors. Chris Glenn has served as surrogate in New York City, Surrogates Court, for 6 years, and she's been on the civil court of the City of New York, and she's been a justice of the Supreme Court of New York, and associate justice for the First Judicial District. And she has written decisions regarding AIDS, sexual harassment, the rights of physical and mentally disabled, and numerous others. She is a teacher for more than 20 years. She founded the Women's Law Clinic at New York University, and she served as dean. I believe that we're going to hear first from Judge Glenn. Here's Judge Glenn.
So I was dean of CUNY, the public interest law school, not of NYU. Excellent as its public interest program is. I'm really excited that there are so many of you left because I have a general sense that this is a kind of ADA crowd, and what we're going to be talking about is not so obviously an ADA issue, although I will explain why, thanks to Leslie Saltzman, we also think of it that way. But I think it's really an important issue, and Bob and I have kind of broken this up so it'll be more a conversation between us than total talking heads, because it is close to lunch and you've been at panels and so forth for 2 days. So anyway, thank you for being here. I was very taken yesterday because I had some apprehension about talking about this issue about people with intellectual disabilities and their rights, because again, it seems a little bit outside of what is generally talked about at Ten Brook, although one of the wonderful things about this conference has been how cross-disability it really is. But yesterday, these issues came up again and again in funny ways, and I heard particularly an emphasis on the issue about choice and real choice versus no choice and so forth. And being able to make your own choice, whether it's where to live or who to associate with or really simple questions like what to eat or what to wear on any given day is obviously absolutely essential to the issues of autonomy and dignity and self-realization that we all believe in. And so the first piece about decision making is just being recognized about that you have a right to make these choices. And I think that this is not just about people with intellectual disabilities. Certainly, historically, people with visible disabilities and other disabilities have been treated as if they don't have the capacity to make choices in some sort of implicit way. And always, I think, in the disability area, there is some tension between autonomy and protection. And in some areas of choice, that becomes really exacerbated, and I would sort of mention as one of those the choice about whether to have sex and with whom, and how that plays out, particularly in segregated settings, and whether or not you're a person with an intellectual disability. So the ability to make decisions is critical. But given the title of this symposium this year, and Ten Brooks' famous language, the right to live in the world involves not only the right to make the decision, but to have it recognized and to have it legally recognized. And so there is the sort of implicit, you don't really have the right to make these decisions, or we're the parents, or we're the providers, or we're the segregated setting who's going to make these decisions for you. But then there is the way the state comes in, and in a way that is, in fact, the violence of the state because of the power behind it, says you do not have the right to make decisions anymore, and we are giving the right to make those decisions for you to some other person, and that is guardianship. And I was interested to learn, because I don't think that we've had a similar kind of movement here, but when self-advocates among people with intellectual disabilities first started organizing in Canada in the late 1980s and early 90s, their first demand was to get rid of guardianship. And the Canadians have been working on this ever since, I think in much more interesting and effective and complex ways than we have. But in order to talk about decision making and the convention, I want to just give the tiniest background about guardianship, which is that originally it was pretty awful in ways that we could all recognize. It was plenary, you know, you either had capacity or you didn't have capacity, and if you didn't, everything was taken away from you. It was very diagnosis-driven. It was kind of forever, and there were virtually no procedural protections about when a guardianship was imposed on a person. In the 80s, you know, we as children of the civil rights movement took a civil rights perspective and went around reforming the guardianship laws in this country. Most of which are uniform guardianship laws for all people who have capacity issues. So they cover older persons who have had, quote-unquote, had capacity and lost it, people with psychosocial disabilities, mental illness, as well as people with developmental disabilities. There are 5 states, including my own, that have special guardianship statutes for people with intellectual disabilities. So in this guardianship reform movement, the big changes were, first of all, because we came out of the civil rights movement, lots of procedural protections, burden of proof and right to counsel and on and on and on, right to presence at a hearing, right to hearing, so forth. But also the notion that instead of a diagnosis and a plenary guardianship, that you would actually do a functional analysis and say, what are the particular areas in which a person cannot make a decision, is not capable of making a decision, which puts them in danger and which they are not capable of appreciating the danger from. So it's kind of a 3-part test. And then you, in theory, appoint only a guardian who has the powers to make that kind of decision, but not other kinds of decisions. And so that's the model of a limited guardianship, and the statutes generally have some language about maximizing autonomy and looking at the wishes, needs, and preferences of the person and so forth, who is, of course, called the ward. And that seemed like a great step forward, but it is still a system that is based on, at best, substituted decision-making, which is to say that the guardian makes a decision, and this is particularly the model for older people who have lost capacity as opposed to the developmentally disabled folks, what they would have decided, did they have capacity, and that's what you're supposed to do, and then only if you can't do that do you move to a decision based on the utterly and totally indeterminate and totally value-laden notion of best interests of the person. So it proceeds from a notion of incapacity, and it is the decision of someone else, and it is not the ward making a decision. The ward no longer has the right to make a decision. So that seemed like the best we could do, and there have been a couple of national symposiums on the responsibilities of guardians and on procedural protections and on monitoring to make the system better, to make it less oppressive, to actually create possibilities for people getting out from under it, although that doesn't happen very often. But again, the base premise is always that it is someone else making the decision. That person, the guardian, may consult. That person may even then make the decision which the ward wants made, but it is, as a legal matter, the guardian who is making that decision. And I think Bob raised this yesterday when he was talking about who has the power when you're in a segregated setting, you know, to say, I want out, or I want to stay in the sheltered workshop, or whatever. Is it actually the person, or is it only the guardian who can do that for them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that was kind of the model we had, and not surprisingly, I guess, it wasn't something that fit easily into the ADA. It doesn't look like it's the same kind of situation as other disabilities. And I think that there is a kind of feeling in the general disability community that, you know, the people who really lack intellectual capacity are somehow different. And yes, it's a disability, but kind of different rules apply. So the kind of first breakthrough we had in that was, and it's an article and not decisions, and I don't know that anybody has litigated this, but Leslie Saltzman, who is here, wrote two very influential articles arguing the potential applicability of Olmstead to the right to make decisions, because by not being able to make your decisions, you are removed from an integrated setting, both literally and figuratively, and it's a very interesting argument, and Leslie's here, and we can give you the cites to that. But then along came the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, which just changed everything. And I want to say, with a lot of respect for the people who spoke yesterday and understanding the political positions that they have to take and why they have to be careful about their language, and with the devout hope that there is no one here from the press, that the CRPD that I see, and I think that any of us here who work with, is like real different from what we heard about yesterday. It's not about if you're a blind person and you go abroad, you know, there'll be Braille in the elevators in London. No, it's not about that at all. It's really, it's about human rights. And that is a totally different lens than the lens of civil rights that most of us grew up with and that we utilize in the ADA, really, and in the ways that we've thought about these things and the ways that we've thought about guardianship. So, you know, the first thing about human rights is that you have them by virtue of being human. They're not rights that anybody gives you. You have them. Everyone has them. And so what we say as a mantra about human rights is that they are universal. Everyone has them. They are indivisible. You can't chop them up. They're interdependent and interrelated, which means, for example, in the CRPD, that where Article 19, for example, gives you the right to live in an integrated setting, you know, that has to go back to Article 12. Don't you have the right to make the decision to live in that integrated setting? The right to health care has to include the right to make decisions about the health care you're going to get. So all of the human rights that are enumerated, you know, beginning in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights more than 50 years ago, and then reflected in these specific treaties or conventions for the groups that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights recognized as vulnerable, as needing particular protections in order to exercise and utilize their rights that everybody has, and those were children, people of racial and ethnic minorities, women, the elderly, and people with disabilities. And so far, four have conventions, people with disabilities most recently, that's the CRPD, and older persons still don't, and that's something that we're working on at the UN. So the revolutionary, I mean, and game-changing and paradigm-changing and, you know, brain-shift-changing, that's really hard to get your head around, I think, for a lot of people, and certainly was for me, who came out of the old model, is Article 12. And I want to read you Article 12, because Article 12 says, Persons with disabilities have the right to recognition everywhere as persons before the law. Fine, what does that mean? States parties shall recognize that persons with disabilities enjoy, because it's a universal right and we all enjoy it, legal capacity on an equal basis with others in all aspects of life. And this goes back to the preamble, which says that among the bases of autonomy and dignity and so forth that are protected by human rights is the right to make your own choices. So what legal capacity means, the human right to legal capacity, which is enshrined as indivisible and as inalienable and as interrelated and as interdependent by Article 12, means that everyone has a right to not only make their decisions, but to have those decisions recognized as a matter of law by other people. I mean, that is just a staggering statement that really, it's, you know, it's hard if you've dealt with people with severe disabilities who appear to have no communicative capacity, who are, you know, who can't do ADLs, who are on gurneys, who have never spoken. You know, it's hard to think, well, this person has an absolute right to make decisions and for the world to recognize them, the world in which we want to live as a result of this conference. And it's not immediately apparent how that happens. And so Article 12 goes on to say, and this will resonate, of course, because this is the language and world and set of concepts of accommodations, right? That states parties shall take appropriate measures to provide access by persons with disabilities to the support they may require in exercising their legal capacity. So what that means is that you don't just kind of have the right, but that in order to have that right recognized in the world, you are entitled to accommodations, which in Article 12 is spoken of as support. And that is why what Article 12 requires us to do, don't, you know, tell the State Department, don't tell the Senate, but this is, and obviously it's not self-executing, but it totally moves us from a system of substituted decision-making to a system of supported decision-making. And I'm not just sort of making this up with regard to what the impact on guardianship is. Well, I'll be talking more later about what's going on in the rest of the world and what we're trying to do here. But already the committee, which is set up as the monitoring body under this convention, has reviewed four member states' submissions about what they were doing under the CRPD. And with regard to each of them, the committee has said, your guardianship laws are in violation. You cannot have guardianship laws based on substituted decision making. You have to get rid of them. So, I mean, this is really a big change. So all I want to suggest now, and then Bob is going to talk about why this is important to you, why you should care about this, but I hope you do, is a way to think about those supports before we get into sort of more nitty-gritty. And the supports that the accommodation, the support slash accommodations that we have to give people in order to fully recognize and actualize their human right to legal capacity, it really comes in three places about support services or accommodations. The first is to assist a person in formulating their purposes, to explore the range of choices, and then to make the decision. So, I mean, you could go through all of that and think about what kinds of supports you'd need, about how you talk differently or how you communicate things, how you do it slowly, quickly, how you use examples, et cetera, and how you come to making a choice. The second is a kind of variation on that, which is the supports that are necessary to engage in the decision-making process with other people, to make agreements that give effect to one's own decisions where one's decisions require that. So, for example, in guardianship proceedings, I've had a lot of young people who have said, you know, I can do a lot of things on my own, but whenever I get into that medical setting, I just glaze over and it's scary and I don't feel like I can function. I want my mom to be able to do that. Okay, fine. There are much more complex kinds of decision making. And obviously, in terms of keeping people out of guardianship, we always think about advanced directives, including durable powers of attorney and healthcare proxies. You run up against the question, well, do they have the capacity to enter into those? And so that's all the part two, which is the entering into agreements that allow other people to make the decisions that you would have made, and you're choosing who is making those decisions and what kind of decisions they're making. And then the third, which we really can't forget, because legal capacity, you know, the whole world of contracts and so forth is about mutual obligations, is that people then need the supports to act on the decisions they've made and to meet their obligations under any agreements that are made for that purpose. So the range of supports is different depending on which piece you're looking at. It's complicated. Do we know how to do this? Do we have best practices for this? You know, have we ever thought through this? That's all stuff, I guess, that we'll be talking about in a minute. But I wanted you to understand that you're really engaged in a paradigm shift here. That if we believe this, and somebody yesterday asked the question, if we don't believe it, how can we persuade other people? So we have to believe that every person has the capacity to make his or own choices, and that to make those a matter of legal capacity, which is choices that can be recognized, like every other disability, require accommodations, or as we would call them here, supports, and that it's up to us to figure out what those supports are so that that human right can be given full enjoyment, so that people with intellectual disabilities, with psychosocial disabilities, people who have lost capacity as a result of the diseases and problems and so forth of aging have and can exercise their full human rights. So Bob is, so if I haven't persuaded you why this matters, Bob is now going to actually tell you why it does.
I was just going to say you should care because we care, and we know how supportive an environment you will provide for us. I think I'm kidding, actually. No. First of all, it's always a pleasure to speak at the Ten Broeck Symposium, and I've been honored to be on the planning committee for these conferences since the beginning, and it is wonderful to see how they have evolved over time in a lot of ways, both in numbers and in subject matter. And I think Chris alluded to that it has become a wonderful cross-disability and cross-issue group. The second thing that always comes to the fore when thinking about this symposium is, and we alluded to it yesterday, is the very famous formulation that Dr. Ten Broeck gave us, which is the right to live in the world. And really, when you think about the issues of decision-making and choice and whether or not to have a guardian, that is a really classic expression of the right to live in the world. And I think that what we have seen is that many people don't have that right, and whereas perhaps a generation ago the large focus was on people who didn't have that right because they were literally segregated away, and of course that still happens, now we have people who in theory have the right to live in the world but don't actually get to live in the world in the way that we do, that is, people with either not with intellectual disabilities or not with disabilities at all, for whom a lot of the things that we talk about are just taken for granted. I say this to my friends in the self-advocacy movement when they say this, and I sort of blanch a little bit, that people will come up sometimes and say, well, you know, just so you know, I'm my own guardian. And I want to point out, people who don't think about having guardians don't actually go around thinking that they're their own guardian. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was going through school and, you know, you could say something, you needed the support, you know, the approval of your parent or guardian, I always wondered who that guardian guy was, because no one ever said really what that person was, and I never had to deal with it. But the way in which this kind of concept of guardian is the default mode for lots of people is that they kind of think of it as, oh, gee, I'm my own guardian, which is just an interesting concept and not a very helpful one. I also thought it was interesting yesterday, Jonathan Young, who did the lunch speech, for those of you who are here, said something interesting. It's kind of the flip side of the issue of legal capacity. And he said that in talking about FDR, and how was it that somebody who was a wheelchair user could be president of the United States during the 30s, during the Depression, the World War II. And he said, well, because he was so clearly had capacity that no one would have thought of him as having a disability. Now, we know that, of course, and again, it was a different time, he certainly didn't go out of his way to identify as a person with a disability. But isn't that interesting that the kind of internalization of disability as incapacity is such that when we see somebody with capacity, we don't think, oh, isn't that interesting? People with disability have capacity. Think, oh, must not have a disability, notwithstanding what our eyes might show us. So it's just, you know, we're in guardianship world now, which means everything that you think you know is wrong, everything that goes one way goes another, and sometimes you have to scratch your head and think, really, is that what they're thinking about? So a couple of things why you should care about this. One of the reasons you should care about this is because when we think about what it is that makes us who we are, and there could be many ways of looking at this, but certainly the ability to make choices in the way we wish to make those choices is one of those pieces of it. And one of the things I want to say is that sometimes when we're talking in our disability bubble, we run the risk of comparing people with disabilities in one aspect to some external other group and try to imagine what that other group is. And I think about that a lot when we talk about issues of capacity, because sometimes the standards that people apply to people with disabilities are standards that no one without disabilities would ever meet. So I always think about this with regard to voting. And after 2000, I think we could probably fairly say there are a lot of people who maybe aren't so clued in as to how to vote. This is not whether they have a disability or not. Well, what is the standard for capacity? What is the knowledge you need to have in order to be able to vote? And I would dare say it can't be where you have to be able to identify who the candidates are, what their positions are, what the pros and cons of those positions are, and articulate that, because most people don't vote that way. Perhaps it would be good if they did, but they don't. So that can't be the standard. Sexual expression, what should the standard be for there? You know, you have to be able to describe the process with great detail and understand all the pros and cons of sex. Have you lived in this world? Do you think people make decisions about sex that way? I don't know. That's not been my experience. So it doesn't mean that we should dumb it down and give no information to people, but it does mean that our standard of comparison has to be realistic. Now, there's a caution, and the caution is this. I've learned over the years that you cannot assume that people, any people, but now we're talking about people with intellectual disabilities, necessarily know the kind of things you know as a person in the world, because they may have lived in very protected situations where they weren't exposed to certain things. So I'm going to, in my later section, talk a little bit about some examples of decision making, but I'll give you one now, which is one that I enjoy telling, and I know the person I'm telling it about would enjoy it, because we've talked about this. So when I was on the President's Committee on Mental Retardation, we got one time to visit President Clinton in the Oval Office, which we only got because John F. Kennedy Jr. was on the committee at that time. And one of the people on the committee was a self-advocate, a very well-known self-advocate, T.J. Monroe. And T.J., if some of you might know him, used to wear this very broad-brimmed hat. He was quite a character, and he'd walk around with the hat. And so we were waiting outside to go into the Oval Office, you know, imagining all kinds of things, which I won't go into. T.J. was, as was his wont, wearing his hat. And I just, you know, I was friends with T.J., and I just said to him, well, T.J., I just want to ask you something. I know you're wearing your hat. I said, yeah. Do you know that some people think that inside, that men generally take their hats off unless they have a religious reason to wear their hat? And I know there's a man in the back with his hat on, so I'm not at all making any statement about that. So he said, no, I didn't know that. Of course, he had grown up in an institution, and he'd lived outside of the institution for a while, but he had never had this. And you know, I'm not sure where in the curriculum of life you get the don't wear a hat inside, but wherever that was, he had not been there in class that day. And so I said, do you want to wear, you know, if you, now that you know that sometimes people think that men should take their hats off, what do you want to do? And I'll take my hat off. I wasn't trying to make any statement. I didn't know. Now, it would have been fine with me, of course, if he kept his hat on. It would have, you know, it was not my issue. But I wanted to make sure he knew that this was a choice he had. And I couldn't just assume, hey, want to wear your hat or not? Because if I didn't say anything else, he might not have known there was any kind of issue there. He might have wondered why I'm asking. And he might have asked me to follow up on that. But the point is that it's not that everything gets reexamined that way, but I think we do have to be careful about our assumptions about what people actually know. The other thing is this I want to say about decision making, and that is if we think about decisions that are important to us in our lives, there are very few that we make in complete isolation. There are very few of things that matter where we don't talk to anybody, and more importantly, where someone is assessing us to see how well our decisions might go without being able to talk to others about it. So when we think about how do we test and check the capacity of people with disabilities and put them in a testing situation, so, well, here's your example. How would you handle this or that? It's different from the way we might decide whether to buy a house, whether to purchase a car, whether to, you know, get a particular streaming video from Netflix. In those things, we would maybe talk to somebody, our family member, a friend, somebody else, and say, well, what do you think about that? And, you know, here's, should I do this, should I do that? And so that should be the kind of process that we would ask people with to look at people with disabilities for. With this important caveat, again, distinct from the way it's often the case for people with disabilities, you get to choose who you talk to, and you get to choose whether to follow what they're saying, right? As an adult, you should be say, well, you know, I know mom told me this, but I think I'm going to do something a little bit different. And we should say, not, oh my God, doesn't know how to make a good decision, but actually, wow, showing independence, taking into account the position, but not doing it otherwise. So I'm going to end with, at this point, one more point, and then I want to tell just one more story, and then I'll sit down. So the point I wanted to make about capacity, because Chris mentioned it, and Article 12, and both Chris and I have written about this, and it is the critical article of the CRPD, I think. When it was being debated and drafted, and indeed in its first form, right after the adoption of the convention, there were some countries that wanted to have a footnote in Article 12 to what capacity meant. And they said, there's a difference between having legal capacity in general as a human right, which everyone has, and the capacity to act. That some people with capacity, in the human rights term, might not have the capacity to act. This, of course, could have swallowed the rule quite easily because you could imagine a situation, and we could call it guardianship, in which somebody would say, well, you know, okay, we assume you have the capacity, human rights, but, you know, you don't really have the capacity to act. Well, that footnote was taken out. It was very clear that the people who had been behind the drafting of Article 12 and ultimately the enactment of it there was no doubt about this. This is not a distinction that we recognize. We recognize that some people, in order to have their capacity, are going to need help. They're going to need support. And that's why the supported decision-making model is so powerful. But it isn't this distinction between acting and some kind of inherent human right that you have. And that's a very critical thing. There isn't so much, there's other legislative history, if you will, about the CRPD, which comes into play with things like coercive treatment, for example. But this is one case where it's about as clear as it could be. So my last story for this segment about choice. I have a sister with an intellectual disability, and some of you who know me know that I often incorporate her into my comments because she's taught me more about disability than certainly that I have taught her. And one of the long-standing debates we've had over the years, which is never ending, is whether she should be able to have a Diet Coke. And I say that not because I care whether she has a Diet Coke, but her doctors tell her, you know, you shouldn't have so much soda, try to limit that, and she's always negotiating. Well, if I have two sodas, is that okay? Well, maybe, because the doctor said I shouldn't have any. So, well, maybe think about having one, but, you know, like at lunch or dinner. And we went through this negotiation. Okay, I'll have just one. If I have it at lunch, I won't have it at dinner. I said, great, that's great. And I'm mostly just saying, this is terrific, you're working through it. I would say, you know, have as much soda as you want. But, you know, I knew she was also trying to follow what the doctor said in her way. So I go out to lunch with her at one point, or to dinner with her, and she'd had a soda that day for lunch, so we were talking about dinner's coming. What are you going to have to drink? Oh, I'm going to have water because I had soda before. That's great. You're following. The doctor will be so proud of you. Everything is all set up. The waiter comes over and says, you know, to me, what do you want to drink? I'll have some water. He says to her, would you like a Diet Coke? And she lights up and says, a Diet Coke? Yes, I want my Diet Coke. Well, you know, she made a choice. She made an autonomous choice. She knew what my view was. She will drink Diet Coke to the day she dies as much as she wants, but she will pretend that she's actually following what either the doctor says or what I say. But I'm fully able to think, you know, she's in there kicking and making her decision. And so I can't just say, if I said to her, hey, it's your decision, whatever you want, that wouldn't actually help her. That actually wouldn't support her because she is looking for guidance, but not too much guidance.
Are you going to talk more?
Yeah, more.
Okay. When you guys get done, let me know, because I got a question for you.
Okay. So He's a hard act to follow because he gets to tell all the funny stories, and I just have to tell you what's actually going on. But this is a... I actually have one funny story. So stick with me through the boring part. So the question is, all right, we have this human right, and let's hope that we ratify the convention. And even if we don't ratify the convention, we've signed it, and it is out there, and it is, you know, a source of argument and of demands that we can make in the world about what, among other things, substantive due process would require. And so how do we get there? But it seems really daunting, again, because while Bob's stories are wonderful stories, these are pretty high-functioning people, and there are people who are not so high-functioning, and that's always what gets trotted out. You know, you take as Michael Bach, who is the big guru on this, says, you know, you look at the 5% at the bottom, and that becomes the argument for why the other 95% should get nothing. And it's hard. And I think one of the things also that we have to recognize that there's some real differences between the three groups who are affected by this, which is the people with developmental disabilities, the people with psychosocial or mental illness issues, and then the people who, quote unquote, had capacity and have lost it, which are generally older people. And there are different strategies and so forth. What I find really comforting about the human rights regime and structure and the conventions is that they recognize that it's not so easy to get from there to here or from here to there or whichever, from the bad place to the good place. And so there's a notion, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, forgive me for repeating it, but of progressive realization. And I think that's the model that we have to adopt here, because we're not going to move tomorrow to supported decision making. Nobody's going to change the laws. The courts aren't going to strike down the guardianship statutes. And we don't have the supports in place, and I don't think we know how to do all these supports, so that if we did strike down the statutes tomorrow, it's just like if we close the homes, close the supported workshop, what would we do? But what progressive realization says is you have to have a plan, you have to see what the end point is, and then you have to figure out how to get there and do it in steps. And that's what I think we need to talk about. And the good news here, which is again quite contrary from what we heard yesterday morning, is not only that we are not alone, but that we are way behind everybody else. So we have the rest of the world to look at. And rather than our being the carriers of the, you know, flag of freedom and telling everybody else around the world how to do it, everybody else or an awful lot of people around the world have been working on it for a while. Certainly many of the countries that ratified the CRPD early and understood the significance of Article 12, and that includes every country in the European Union and the European Union itself, which had never as a body ratified anything before. So one of the things that's happened in Europe is that the EU has funded 17, I think, what are called Dream Scholars. It's an acronym for something, which I don't remember. But they're in each of the countries, and they're looking at and working on changing what the guardianship law or whatever it's called. It has some really funny name in Ireland, where it hasn't changed since 1893. Into a system of supported decision making. And very often that is happening really hand in hand, civil society and the government itself. I mean, it's just a totally different situation from what we have here. So there are people who have been really working on this and have been holding meetings and focus groups and, you know, talking to legislators and talking to people with disabilities and working with self-advocates and working with parents who, of course, as you can imagine, are often a hard sell with regard to this, and with service providers who are a hard sell with regard to this, and have drafts of legislation or have drafts of general principles. So there's a lot of that stuff out there. The Canadians have been working on this for a very long time because of the power of the People First Movement in Canada and because the folks in the disability rights community in Canada really listen to them. And they have now some very complicated and brilliantly and carefully thought out draft legislation, which I think maybe they're first going to take to Newfoundland and Labrador or PEI at one of the provinces, because they're, you know, like we are, a federal system. But it's happening in other parts of the world, not in the EU. I'm actually going to speak, not the vacation spot of the world, but in May at a conference in Serbia that's called by their by their Department of Justice and by civil society to talk about how to move to supported decision making. People have been working in Zambia on this, a lot of people working in Latin America. So it's not something where we have to start from scratch, but what is kind of missing, with the exception of Canada, well, you know, there's always Sweden, but Sweden has so many social services that it's hard to compare or think about it as being a great model for us. But Canada has something in British Columbia and to a lesser degree in some other provinces that's been around for a while called representation agreements, which are kind of like advance directives, and the kind of neat thing about them is that they require a lower level of quote-unquote capacity in order to have them recognized than, for example, the capacity to sign a durable power of attorney, which, you know, can always be challenged. And part of the real problem in terms of thinking about legal capacity is not just that we would recognize it, but that you rub up against third parties and institutions in the world, and they want to know, how can I be protected if I, in fact, give credence to this person's decision-making? So the doctor who's afraid they're going to be sued for battery, the bank who's afraid they're going to be sued, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there are all these places that people bump up against, service providers, obviously the healthcare system, the financial system being major ones, but, you know, even just like, you know, getting an apartment, this is where you want to live. Well, how do you actually exercise that? And how does the landlord know that if he signs a contract with you, somebody isn't going to come back and say later, well, she didn't really have capacity, so she doesn't have to pay those 4 months of rent, et cetera, et cetera. So part of the problem or the challenge here is figuring out how to create a system not only in which we support people in the three ways that I talked about to make decisions, but to make sure that those decisions get legally recognized or that people, that third parties can act on them. And the representation agreements are one model for that, and they're having real conversations with the Banking Association in Canada. As Michael Bach says, they're really quick to take your money, but then to let you withdraw it is a different matter altogether. So these are all issues, and we thought about, well, how do we go about bringing this into American jurisprudence? And again, you know, the CRPD, even if ratified, is not self-executing, so it's not like I walk into court in New York State and say Article 17A, which has no protections and only plenary guardianship, you know, is a violation of this convention, it's gone. Which, by the way, the Russian Supreme Court has said. It has said that the Russian guardianship statute is unconstitutional and violates the CRPD because it only has plenary guardianship. So this idea that we're ahead of everybody and we're the carriers of freedom and justice and equality, even Russia, even Serbia, right? I mean, that's how scary it is. So the model that we, and we share this because we hope you'll be part of it, the guardianship reform that happened in the 80s from the civil rights perspective, started really with the American Bar Association commissions on what are now called law on aging and disability rights, who convened a conference in Wingspread, Wisconsin, and a very interdisciplinary conference and multi-days, and at the end of it came out with a whole series of recommendations about how guardianship should be reformed. Those were taken to the ABA. Those were adopted by the House of Delegates. And that was very powerful, of course, because the ABA is a pretty conservative organization. And with the imprimatur of the ABA on these recommendations, you could then shop them around to the states. And so there was this massive guardianship reform, which we thought was pretty good at the time, and now which we realize was, you know, in a system which is now completely suspect and hopefully soon to be defunct. But that was the kind of model we were thinking about. And so in the fall, we got some funding, and we did a roundtable bringing together people from all parts of the intellectual disability community, service providers, special ed people, docs, psychologists, parents, siblings, self-advocates, lawyers, people from PNAs, and so forth. And kind of what we had hoped was that we would come out of that with a plan to move towards a national symposium, which would come out with principles. And I'm the person who's supposed to be writing up this roundtable, and I will tell you that it's, you know, more questions, more how do we do this, more we need examples. we're not ready to move towards, setting standards for the world yet. We really need to think this through more, and I think that's going to be the process. But certain things did come out of it, and they really resonated for me yesterday, and I, want to highlight them, which is that a huge piece of it is education. I mean, and education at every level. Education of people with intellectual disabilities from, pre-nursery to the minute they transition out in how to make decisions, education of their parents about how people can make decisions and should be encouraged and taught to do so, so that they have the confidence to let go at the end of the day, education about support services and providers and regulators, including DOE, telling DOE, hoping that we can tell DOE to send out a Dear Colleague letter saying, do not send letters to people getting out of special ed's parents saying you should get a guardianship. In fact, there are alternatives and you shouldn't use it, and here are the things you can do. Educating the community at large that people, even people with severe intellectual disabilities, have this right and can with support, and then figuring out what those supports look like and how to teach people to provide those supports. And it's very interesting. We have very few on-the-ground models of at least documented models. And Nina Cohn, who's at Syracuse, has written an article saying we don't have enough evidence yet. We have to be very skeptical about this and so forth, which is true. But recently, it came to our attention that there was a demonstration project, to use the word, in Texas, where they were going to put volunteers to avoid guardianship, train volunteers and put them with people with intellectual disabilities and therefore create supported decision-making and so forth. And I mean, they write it up as if it's a great success, but it points out all the problems. First, they started with medical decision-making documents, and doctors would not accept them. Doctors took the position, I don't care if you've done a healthcare proxy, I want to know that this person has capacity to make this decision and can explain what it means, and da-da-da-da-da. So they just let that one go. And then they tried to recruit people with intellectual disabilities, and the providers wouldn't refer anybody because the providers were afraid that the volunteers would then interfere with the provision. The providers thought, we're the people who are best the ones to give advice. The parents were terrified. So the idea of having to educate the whole community and the whole world about the capacities of this kind of last island of disability community to be full human beings in the world and to live in the world is an enormous task. And, it's something that we have to figure out. And fortunately, I think instead of believing that we have to do it overnight, we have the sort of calming notion of progressive realization, and that we can do this in a systematic way, and that we have an incredible amount to learn from other people, both who have thought through the legal and philosophical issues and the practical issues in very much more substantial ways than we have even begun to do, but also who are now starting to put on the ground demonstration projects and pilot projects, and we need to do that as well. So I was going to tell you my one story about this. So at the round table, a woman is telling a story about how she has a daughter with intellectual disabilities, and she's really been working on trying to create a circle of supporters to help her daughter make decisions. And they're all talking, and they've all sort of worked out different things they're going to do. And then she's talking to some of her daughter's friends, and her daughter's friends say, well, do any of these people who mostly are your friends, like, do they know anything or can they tell her anything about decisions about how to use a bong and when? And our participant said, and then I knew that when you have supporters, they have to be peer appropriate as well as responsibly appropriate. So the whole, the whole range of decisions that people have to make and thinking about how they get assistance in doing that is like, it's a huge job. And we at the Commission on Disability Rights at the ABA and the Commission on Law and Aging, who's been enormously helpful to us, and AIDD and Commissioner Sharon Lewis, who is just absolutely wonderful and is completely behind this. We have a lot of work to do, and we encourage you to join us. And now Bob's going to tell you some more funny stories.
And I'm just going to take a few minutes because we want to give you a chance to ask questions. And I know Dr. Maurer probably has a question or two because he always does. Yeah. One of the things is, and I like the last point about education, I think an important group that needs to be educated is lawyers. And lawyers need to know what kind of protection, legal protection to provide for their clients, whether their clients are people with disabilities or family members who are seeking assistance with their adult children. Because some of the laws that are on the books, while not perfect, and I agree with Chris that even with limited guardianship, that's not supported decision making. But the fact is that even in many states, and almost every state has a limited guardianship, it's not used. The lawyers don't ask for it. The clients don't know that it exists, so they don't ask for it in the first place. The lawyers don't propose it. The clerks don't want to be bothered, and the judges don't want to be bothered. And they all say things like, it'd just be more efficient, it's easier if you just come in one time and then you get your guardianship. Well, I think we have to fight back against that. And in our clinic, and some of our clinic students are here today, we've tried to do that in a variety of ways to not ask for more authority than we need if we are in a position where we have an individual with a disability where for some reason there's a question about his or her capacity. So for example, in one case where we are a limited conservator, where our client is employed, handles her own money in lots of ways, but has a couple of big income items that she doesn't have control over. The perception was that she needed assistance with that, and we have a limited conservatorship for that. But she had asked us, not as part of the conservatorship, but whether we could look at her bank accounts from time to time, just to make sure that things are going okay and that no one's taking advantage of her. But she didn't necessarily want, and we didn't ask for any right to make, to take money out or anything like that. It was really just an ability to take a look at these statements. So we went, my student team and I went to the bank to try to set this up. So first of all, of course, we run into the problem that's been alluded to both today and earlier. What if the other side won't play? What if the bank doesn't recognize that you have this authority? We had the order from the court that we were the limited conservator, and so we're meeting with the bank official who, of course, says, well, I have to check with legal. So they call up legal. I always wonder, again, what legal is. It's like, this kind of entity out there. Well, legal is on the phone, and we're sitting there. Of course, we can't talk to legal directly. We're only in the room with the call. And legal reports, well, how can she do? Oh, and we had this power of attorney that was going to allow us to have this access to the account to observe. So legal's question was, well, how can she have a power of attorney? She's got a limited conservatorship. She doesn't have capacities. Well, no, if you look, she's only got the limited conservatorship for this point. So we actually got past that, but the question was, how could she be doing this? This is not acceptable. But then, of course, legal needed to take some time to look this over. So we finally, I think last week, got a telephone call from the bank person who kept in touch with us to say, I'm trying to see what's going to happen. And finally, legal said, okay, we'll go forward with this. But it took... In this case, is somebody with two law students, a law teacher, and having to make several trips to the bank just to arrange this. And how many folks are going to get through that kind of process? With this same client, by the way, when we were meeting with her and she brought a staff person with her to get the limited power of attorney to just look at the bank account, the staff person said, because we were the successor limited conservator, we were not the first entity. The staff person said, well, how come you're only looking for this limited power of attorney? Why don't you get, broader power? And, because the other conservator had a full power of attorney. And totally unprompted, and the students did this, said, well, we don't need any more than that, so we're only asking for the authority we need. Well, and it's interesting, because the staff person sort of lit up and said, oh, isn't that nice, or isn't that interesting? Because it never occurred to her that anybody wouldn't want the most discretion, the most authority, and I'm sure we wouldn't have abused it, and I'm also sure that the prior conservator didn't observe it either. But it's that mindset of, well, it's just easier if I have more, doesn't always play well. And then finally, in one of our other cases, not one I supervised, we were for a variety of reasons, we were asked to be, we were appointed by a court to be guardian ad litem for an individual who first the issue was whether we would be able to consent on her behalf to deal with discovery issues. And then secondarily became, could we consent on her behalf for a negotiated agreement? And I have to say that although she was represented by legal aid and everybody was well-intentioned, everybody in the case would have been quite happy if we had just signed off for her without ever even talking to her, because we, after all, were the guardian ad litem. We were the person, the entity that they should be looking to. And again, to the credit of our students, they said, well, no, we're going to talk to her. We need to find out what's going on with her. She's got to be behind this. This was a person with a psychosocial disability. So again, as Chris says, the issues are somewhat different, I think, depending on the group we're talking about. But it's plainly somebody who had an opinion, who could speak to this issue, and who's, and this is ultimately, I think, important, whose ability to live with whatever decision was made would be much stronger if she actually was involved in the procedure. But had we not insisted, it surely could have gone forward without anybody ever looking at her. So when we're talking about supported decision making and the ways in which it's set up both formally and informally and whether people have people in their lives to help them, part of the issue is to really think very carefully about what kind of decisions have to be made, what kind of support is needed, how to give respect to the individual, which doesn't mean just saying either do this or whatever you say is okay, but really engaging with the individual to provide the support that he or she needs, and to be out there challenging DOE or challenging the local school district if they're saying, well, once the student turns 18, the parent needs to have a guardianship or they're not going to have any role in the student's life going forward, or challenging others who are saying, this is the thing we have to do. I mean, in the end, it's really the old saw that when all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Well, I think we need more than one hammer because we certainly have more than one nail. Thanks.
So Judge Chris and Professor Bob, I got a question for you. It goes like this. I was at the National Convention of the Federation. A fella came to see me. He was with a buddy. I knew the buddy. He said, I am 22. He said, my dad had been married to a woman, but he got a divorce, and so he married this other woman, and then he died. And she has guardianship over me, and she has me working in a sheltered workshop, and I don't want to work there, and I want to go visit my mother, who lives in another state, and my guardian won't let me. Who do I sue? Who is the plaintiff?
Well, most statutes sort of provide for a termination of guardianship on the finding that it's no longer needed, which of course is a little different than finding that it shouldn't have been imposed in the first place, but you can make that argument. The statute that we have in New York for people with intellectual disabilities doesn't even have that, amazingly enough, but most statutes do. So this young person could go into the court where the guardianship was created in the first place and argue that it's no longer needed because he has the capacity to make decisions and to appreciate the dangers in his life and whatever it was that caused them to do it in the first place. He sounds like a pretty articulate guy, and he had, and he had a friend who was somebody who you know, and he was at the convention. So he's in a pretty good situation, and I suppose, you know, if he were really lucky, you'd send him to Dan's office, and then it would all be better, and then you'd have to figure out which circuit you were in, but whatever. But most people don't have that. I mean, that's the problem. It's one of the reasons why, even in the existing statutes, the question of sort of periodic review and reporting is absolutely critical, and does the need continue? But there are certainly many, many people for whom guardianships have been awarded who don't need them. And particularly with people with intellectual disabilities, the assumption is, and it's quite overt in my statute, which is just a DD and MR statute, that once you have this disability, you have it forever. And it's a completely static situation, and it leaves out the possibility that people grow and learn and develop capabilities that they didn't have when they were 5 or 7 or 13 or whatever. Technically, you can do it, but getting into court, figuring out who's going to represent you to get into court, understanding that you have that right in the first place, is like everything else. And needless to say, it's not something that, at least at this moment, we would recognize a constitutional right to counsel for. So if you are not only, relatively disabled, but also have no money, the likelihood that you're going to be able to do this, especially in the decreasing numbers of legal services lawyers and so forth, is, it's a remedy without it's a right without a real remedy, I think.
I'll just add, I mean, I agree with that. Part of the insidious nature of legal capacity and its perceived absence is that sometimes the issue is, well, you can't challenge your guardianship because you don't have the capacity to bring this challenge. And if that sounds a little Orwellian to you, since we've been talking up Russia, we can talk down Russia in a very well-known case, the Shukhtarov case, where a guardian was appointed for an individual without his knowledge, and 6 days later, the guardian put him into what is called a social care home, which is kind of equivalent to our nursing homes, and then the Russian court would not let him challenge it because they said, you don't have legal capacity. Somehow, this individual got to the attention of the Mental Disability Advocacy Center in Budapest, which does a lot of work in this area. They brought ultimately a successful case before the European Court of Human Rights. So this, and we see lots of situations where people who have guardians, where the guardians assert that nobody can have any kind of contact with them whatsoever, including and in particular to discuss the possibility of getting out from under the guardianship. So it's certainly a role where PNAs can play and other people who come for whom these issues come to their attention. But it is almost a perfect circle unless you figure out a way to pierce it.
Yes, my circumstances were all in the U.S. Questions for these folks?
I have a question. I'm Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi. I found your presentation incredibly ironic. So I'd like to actually, if you don't mind, push back. You were talking about the rights of the human rights of people with disabilities to make their own choices. Yet for a day and a half, we've been in conferences where the lawyers here, it's been assumed that the lawyers have to work without choice, as if the laws are presented in a certain way and the judges are presented in a certain way. And I've heard several times people say, well, I got a good judge, or I got a bad judge, or I didn't like the law. But I didn't hear anyone on the panel talking about the treaty, which you also talked about, saying I'm going to proactively change that. The only speaker who really wanted to change the environment was Dr. Young, who talked about the importance of political power. So I want to raise this issue, which I asked of the an earlier panel on the treaty, about reaching out to Christian evangelicals and to Catholics, to mass-attending Catholics. They are one-third of the American electorate. They are 54% of the Republican primary voter pool. They listen to Rick Santorum. They listen to Sarah Palin. They listen to the other parents of kids with disabilities like Pete Sessions and Kathy McMorris Rogers. Why is it that the people in this room don't have a sophisticated outreach to talk to them? I mean, I heard you, with all due respect, talk about choice from a podium about something that is a very important issue, but I can tell you that if you use the word choice with that audience, they hear abortion. You know, you should be using the word human rights and not and dignity and liberty, but the word choice is going to automatically alienate Republicans who can vote, who can be those votes on that treaty that already voted against it. We need them to change their votes. So I'm sorry, I really want you to address how do we change the environment that we work in so that we can have our own choices about how to empower and advocate for people with disabilities.
Well, I want to answer that obliquely. I mean, obviously, this is a political issue, and it presupposes that we can educate people in general about the core principle that people with intellectual disabilities are people who have the right to live in the world, and that right includes the right to make decisions that are legally recognized, and that's a heavy lift. One of the problems that so I'm just going to take this as a springboard, one of the problems that was identified, obviously, in the roundtable, and that I think we face, is that there's sort of no central place where this is being discussed. There's no organization that's taken this on. There's nobody who's collecting all the information. There's nobody who's getting the grants or getting paid to do it. There are a bunch of us who are trying, you know, from our little perches wherever we are to do little pieces of it, but it's not as, for example, in the European countries, in Canada and so forth, where there's like a real place where it's happening and everybody feeds the information is and the strategy is developed and the how will we talk about this to other people and who are the groups we should. I mean, that doesn't exist. There's no center at all. There are just a bunch of people right now thinking about this from different places in the disability community and the intellectual disability community and the international human rights community. And one of the real challenges that we have is to kind of find a there where we can have these discussions. And I think, you know, what you raise is a good point, and how it gets presented and why it is an issue of dignity and of self-realization and autonomy, and why that's important to all human beings regardless of their religious views or how they feel about abortion, you know. But we have to have a place where that strategy gets talked out, and we don't have that strategy.
You know, I would just add, the part of the power of disability rights has been that it has not been a usual left-right Republican-Democratic kind of issue. That and sometimes this is because disability, of course, doesn't know that boundary. So as we've talked about over 2 days, and it's certainly been true, that many people who get interested in disability issues, including have spoken from this podium, have said, well, I got interested in it because I had a connection to it. That has a way of opening up space, I think, for people whose politics might not otherwise have them vote in a particular way. But with respect to the reaching out, I think what's critical, or what we have to think about from this side, let's say, is that people are very vulnerable to, I think, being scared. And I think some of the tactics, I will just say, that the other side that opposed the CRPD used, particularly with homeschooling parents, were to scare them into thinking, and we've heard this in other debates recently, if this is done, this will cause you, you know, to lose all these rights that you have. The best interest standard will be used, a standard which, by the way, every state in the country uses for determining the rights of children, will be used to take away your rights. So we do need to push back against that, at least with the people who are listening to the Santorums and Palins. Whether those folks themselves are open to that, I think you'll have to, I'll cede that one to someone else who's smarter than I am.
And some of the people you mentioned have been supportive of some of the advantages and the rights of disabled people, although I must admit that I've never noticed Sarah Palin doing so. On the other hand, she doesn't have a vote in the Congress at the moment.
But she has a child with Down
syndrome. Right. Your name?
Larry Berger.
Go ahead.
I want to go back to the comment that the whole structure of guardianship as it exists in the United States doesn't really recognize the fact that people change, and that somebody who might need assistance now may not need the same assistance 5 years or 10 years from now or whatever. And isn't that kind of built in? I have recently been looking at the definition as it has evolved over years of intellectual disability, formerly mental retardation. Mm-hmm. And there's an article about this in a recent AAIDD journal. And isn't that kind of implicitly built into the definition, that it doesn't change? The concept that it originates before age 18 or 20, and then it's not specifically expressed, but the idea is it's a permanent condition that originates before before a certain age.
The condition doesn't change, but the characteristic, and by the way, I think we're going to learn, and we already kind of know this, that what we call intellectual disability, what we used to call mental retardation, is multiple things, and they're not the same thing. The condition may be there in the background, but the capacity that one has can change. It's both contextual, and it is subject to being educated. Again, part of what, you know, my experience has told me is that we don't always know what people know how to do until we actually test that. So in addition to the newer definitions not only reflecting, I'd say, a more pliable sense of what people can actually do, also emphasize something which historically the field hasn't, which is that people come with strengths as well as challenges, and that sometimes those strengths can compensate for some of the things that people lack. So when we used to do the right to habilitation cases in the 70s, David Furlinger is here, one of the prominent people in that. I know one of my colleagues used to say, you know, the way we're describing the people in some of these institutions makes it sound like they're all going to be going to Ivy League schools anytime soon. That isn't going to happen in that way, but there is a lot of movement, and that sense that you have this fixed situation, I think is going to change. The under 18, that this develops developmentally, is more a question of that it is considered to be a developmental condition, so that you can have the same characteristics because you had a traumatic brain injury at age 25, but you wouldn't be classified as having an intellectual disability.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I mean, I wanted to speak to this for a second, because this was one point that we had agreed I would make, and it comes out of this. When he talks about capacity and contextual, a person can have the condition, but a person can, with supports, make decisions because they have the human right to do that. So if they've never been given the supports, obviously they don't know how to make the decision with supports. And so one of the things that can change is that some support system arises around them so that while previously they may have been seen as not able to make decisions, now with that set of supports they can. And I, when we have had conversations earlier about short of abolishing the guardianship system altogether, how can we work within it to at least to try to begin to incorporate supported decision making? So I was very fortunate in a case that I have been watching and dealing with for several years that on literally my last day as a judge on December 31st of 2012, I signed a decision. Unfortunately, the site I can't give you, I don't have it with me, but it's called Matter of Damaris, D-A-M-E-R-I-S-L. And you can find it in, you know, through Lexis and the New York reports, in which I had appointed someone as a guardian for a woman with mental retardation and various other disabilities, and who was, you know, who really was not making decisions, or she was very heavily protected by her mother and so forth. And over the course of the 5 years that I saw her, and for various reasons, she kept coming back, and that's all set out. She married and she got some good social services, and then she moved, and then she had some good neighbors. And by the time I last saw her, she had a support system around her, and she was able to make decisions utilizing that support system. And so I wrote a decision that said, as a matter of constitutional imperative, least restrictive alternative is built into guardianship, so guardianship is last resort. And as a matter of international human rights, supported decision making has to be read into least restrictive alternative. So until you explore and supported decision making doesn't work, you can't do a guardianship. And to go back to Dr. Moore, how you get back in, so for people who are under guardianship, who have or for whom we can create good support systems, you can make that argument that while it may not have happened before, now there is a supported system, so guardianship is no longer required. And that argument, you know, at least I made and substantiated to the extent I could as a matter of federal constitutional law and international human rights law.
Is there any state in the United States that has a periodic review built into its guardianship?
Michigan has, its limited guardianship law has a 5-year sunset. So at the end of 5 years, it's over. I believe then the party seeking guardianship has to repetition with the burden of persuasion. When I last looked, which was a few years ago, that was the only state that had that. And I don't think anybody had it for plenary guardianship.
In theory, the reporting requirements for personal guardianships under the good guardianship statutes require you to say this person still needs guardianship, right? Because, and we've tried X and Y, but of course it doesn't happen and nobody really reviews it and the courts don't care about it.